Hello, welcome to Late to It. I'm Norma Frisby.
I'm Kirsty Dull.
And this is a podcast about reading books at the right time. Kirsty, what have you been reading on time this week?
I have been listening to the autobiography of Britney Spears, which is called The Women in Me, which is not my usual, I have to say, but and I'm not even particularly a Britney Spears fan, but I think I was just sort of I became very curious about her after sort of all the stuff came out about the conservatorship, and the kind of the sort of thing, the strictures she was put under by her father and management and all that sort of stuff. So I downloaded the audiobook, which is read brilliantly by Michelle Williams, and frankly, she deserves a Grammy for it because she's incredible. And it's in some ways it's sort of quite surface. Like, it's not long. It's I mean on in terms of like listening time, it's like under 6 hours or something. But it and there are some bits where it does, like, she doesn't go into detail. She kind of skims over, like, she's talking about how she became famous, and it sort of goes from like 1 minute she's auditioning for the Mickey Mouse Club and gets in, and then she's recording her first album and suddenly she's huge. And that all happens in the space of sort of the equivalent of a few pages, basically. But then there's other stuff, you know. I think as it goes on, as the book goes on, it sort of gets a bit more, she gets very, she's very, very honest about stuff that happened to her. I think that, I mean, the headlines are, "We hate Justin Timberlake. God, what an awful man." And just the stuff that she was put through, but she was essentially sort of kept prisoner, basically, and treated like a performing monkey. She's just exploited repeatedly by people. And what really came across to me was the fact that this was a woman who just wanted a life that was full of love and family. And in some ways, I feel like she would have been much happier if she was, back home in Louisiana, raising a family, just living quite simply. And, in the end, she's ended up in this sort of, sort of definition of the gilded cage, I guess. And she's very honest about herself as well, where she's, particularly in the time after she has two babies very close together. She got pregnant with her second son when her first son was 3 months old, so she basically spent 2 years pregnant, and it was like the paparazzi were after. There's this heartbreaking bit where she's in the hospital having just had her second son, and they're having to devise ways out of the hospital because every time she looks out the window, there's just this mob of and all men, like trying, desperate to get a photo of her children. And she says that, she didn't cope with it, and it made her very controlling. And she's like, I got very weird and very controlling, and we were having the house, my house was getting remodeled, and I wanted white marble floors, and everyone said, this is a terrible idea, they'll be really slippery, and if you fall, it'll be really hard. She's like, it's got to be white marble. And she's like, I just want to apologize to every contractor that I ever dealt with, because like I channeled all this sort of the lack of control in her life. She says, like, I basically channeled this into white marble floors, yeah. And it's just heartbreaking, actually. And I hope she's in a better place. I want only good things for Britney Spears.
Yeah.
And Michelle Williams is amazing.
Oh, Michelle Williams is my favorite actor. In fact, like, people can fight me over this. She is the greatest actor of her generation. Don't come at me with any male names because I'm not interested. She is it. She is it. I love her. So I have started listening to this. I've listened to about an hour, I think. Because I am crap at listening to audiobooks, so it will take me. I couldn't sleep, so I listened to an hour of it a couple of weeks ago, and then I've not touched it since. And it's partly to do with I can't cope with people's words in my ears unless I really want to listen to someone talking,
Mm.
which I know is a bit weird, but I prefer music. So I will listen to it all eventually. Normally, I like listening to audiobooks when I'm wrapping Christmas presents, so it might get listened to while I'm doing that. Because because I hate
Very
wrapping.
seasonal.
Yeah, well, I hate wrapping Christmas presents, so it's great. I can just sit and do it while it's mindless jobs doing it while I've got a podcast on, audiobook on. But yeah, so yeah, I started listening to it after the bit with Michelle Williams mimicking Justin Timberlake. Me, I can't remember who he's meeting.
Genuine, I think.
Yeah, and he flipping puts on his stupid black voice, and oh my God. So she
Hilarious.
takes him off brilliantly. Yeah, so after that clip went viral, I was like, oh yeah, I'm in. Let's go. But yeah, I've like been into pop culture since, I don't know, since before Britney Spears. So yeah, I am interested. I don't know if I've said this on podcast before. My like thing that I love to do is listen to celebrity memoirs, because I love listening to them being read by the celebrities themselves. Although actually, one of the best ones I read was listened to was Elton John's, and Tara Egerton reads that brilliantly, actually, because obviously he played Elton John in the biopic. So yeah, so I'm well up for listening to the rest of it. And I also think it's good that we're having a sort of reckoning about Britney and 90s and what the paparazzi did and how horrendous they were to like young female stars at that time.
I mean, it was horrendous. And I mean, the paparazzi were sort of the, I don't know, I thought, but I think of them as the attack dogs, I suppose. They were the kind of, at one point, she compares them to zombies trying to get into a building, kind of just having to fend off these brainless thugs, essentially, who's trying to storm into whatever building she was in. But it's, you know, it's not just the paparazzi, it's basically everyone around her. There's the, you can see the start of her father's kind of controlling, where it was just after she'd broken up with Justin Timberlake, and she talks, you know, about the fact that she'd been pregnant with him and had an abortion, and how horrendous the experience was, and then how she realizes that he's sort of like just distancing himself from her, and eventually breaks up with her by text message. And she was like, she was utterly, utterly devastated. She thought she was going to get married to him and have babies, and was just desperately in love with him. And then, of course, Cry Me a River came out, and she was like, "Yeah, I did cheat. I cheated on Justin once. It did happen, but he cheated on me multiple, multiple, multiple times, like over and over and over again. But he portrayed me as if I was, you know, the one that devastated him and broke up our relationship, when basically she'd ended up cheating on him once because she knew that she was being cheated on repeatedly, kind of thing. Sort of like not excusing what she did, but kind of going, there was kind of context to it, and he'd been doing it for God knows how long. But then, so of course the press is going wild about this. And she's being castigated everywhere, while at the same time she's basically on the floor. And there's this point where she's in a hotel room in New York, I think, and four people just storm into her apartment. And she's like, there were four men, three of them I didn't recognize, and one was my father. And they basically force her to go and do this big interview with Barbara Walters, in which she's being sort of, you did this terrible thing, you know, sort of like just absolutely destroyed her, basically. Yeah, and it was just one of the many ways that she was absolutely taken advantage of and exploited by her own family.
Yeah, I mean, the bit I listen to, and this sounds like I'm making excuses when I'm not, because once you're an adult, you're responsible for your own behavior, but her family history is horrific.
Absolutely.
So I
Yeah.
didn't know any of that. That's
No,
the
I didn't.
and there's some absolutely horrendous like backstory.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. So the bit I've listened to is really interesting, and I will listen to the rest of it because I am in, I think loads of us are, because the conservatorship became headline news, didn't it? So
Yeah.
yeah.
No, it's brilliant. I mean, that sounds weird, but it is very well done. Yeah, like I said, Michelle Williams is just incredible. So worth it for her narration alone, really.
Yeah, Bob.
What have you been reading?
So I'm going to be an arsehole because I obviously had to read a lot of stuff for events. And as we've talked about, we're both reading quite slowly. So I haven't managed to read anything extra for this week. So I am talking about a book that doesn't come out until May 2024. So if you are late to the podcast, you might be listening to this just at the point this has come out and it's perfect for you. If you are listening to this on time, then here's one for pre-ordering or like, using your Christmas vouchers for or whatever. So this is it's a debut and it's called Cinema Love and it's by Jiemin Tang and it's being published by John Murray's. And I read it because I did what they called a proof party. So if you are not an industry person, that'll mean nothing to you. So proof parties are when, in this case, it was at a literature festival. So it was a local literature festival, and it meant that people could buy tickets to it. Sometimes they're things that are done for bloggers and newspaper readers. I feel like, why am I telling you this, Kirsty? Because you're sitting in front of me. You know how this works. But yeah. So this was so people could buy tickets and they got some Prosecco and they got copies of all three books, which means they go away and read them and tell their friends about it, basically is what it is. And all three, it was three debut writers and all three of them were there. So I sort of did like a little interview with them and they talked about their books. So people got a taste of them and all three are very good. But Cinema Love, I think, is brilliant. Like if I hadn't been told it was a debut, I would not have believed it.
Wow.
So it is, and I think part of so what was interesting about all three books, but this one in particular, is that it's doing something different. So it's about, I mean, if you read the blurb, it tells you that it's about this the gay men in rural China who in the 80s used to meet in cinemas. That's where they would meet other gay men. That's where they so. You see the cinema right at the beginning, and there's basically you can go down a corridor and you end up in the basement, and there's a mattress, and so that's where they go to have sex. So that's how it's sort of being sold on the blurb, but really the story is told from the perspective of the women involved, which makes it a richer story, I think, because all these women that might have been sidelined in this sort of story have got agency. So, it starts, well, it sort of starts off between rural China in the 80s and America slightly later on, New York. But we've got Old Second. So he's part of like there's a group. So he's quite young, back in the sort of Chinese part of the story. But so him and his friends have all got ridiculous nicknames that are like contradictory to what they're really. So there's one who's called something like 169 or 165 that's based on his height because he's really short. That sort of is that sort of nickname. So we meet him and we see him going to the cinema and the person that he's in love with and what have you. But we also see him at this point with Bao Mei, who is his wife, and he knew her at the time because she was the she was the ticket person at the cinema, and she tries to be really nice to all the men, so she's quite sympathetic towards them, and she puts the wives off if they turn up like asking if they've seen her if she's seen their husband. She always lies to them, but her brother is also gay, and this is not a spoiler because it happens in the first bit of the novel. He dies. So she's affected by that, and so she becomes Old Second's wife as a way to sort of they go to America together, and that's a way to protect him. And then in America, we also meet Yan Hua, who I hope I pronounced that right. She, so her first husband, we know, went to the cinema because she turns up at the cinema and is told by Mei that she's never seen her husband. And so she goes to America. Her husband is dead at this point, and she marries a guy called Frog for his green card. She marries this guy called Frog, who is madly in love with her, but she's not as fussed about him, or at least she isn't to start with. So, but they also live with other couples. So there's a couple called May and Kevin because they're immigrants because they can only get low-paid jobs. So there's a point when they're working in a bakery. There's a point where I can't remember whether I think it's her, and not Biome. One of them goes to work in a nail salon, so they do people's nails. So and they're all living together in these absolutely grotty apartments, and every so often they have to move, particularly because Kevin's undocumented. So they have to move and they think they're going to get somewhere better and it ends up being worse. And parts of that are grim. But I thought we'd done in a way that felt different to that to how I've read that story before. I think it's the combination of us following what's happening with the men, because then when they get to America, obviously, there's a point where they start to recognize each other at events. So they've got sort of code sentences that they say to each other. So you see, and all the characters overlap in different ways. So some of the ways that their stories collide don't come clear until later on in the book. But it's been, you know, the comparison title. So it's being sort of marketed as Pachinko, which I've not read but want to, but I've got the sort of sense that it's quite a big sort of family saga type thing, meets Brokeback Mountain. And I'm like, don't think it's inaccurate. Do you know what I mean? It'll give you of what he's trying to do. But it felt to me really rich. It felt like I knew all the characters, that I cared about them, that I was reading a story that's not been told before. And the writing is just brilliant. I mean, I read it in less than a day. I think I picked it up like first thing in the morning and I'd finished it by about 4 o'clock because I just didn't put it down. So yeah, superb. So it's not out until May. It's already sold in America as well. I think it comes out slightly earlier in America. But yeah, Cinema Love by Jiemin Tang. It's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
That sounds fantastic. And I love books that do that thing where the characters sort of cross each other's paths and it's not always immediately obvious. Like one of my favorite books is Ghost Written by David Mitchell.
Oh yeah.
And it I that's sort of like the prime example for me of that happening, of the each section there's a kind of continuation. The characters all turn up, and I mean, I think it can be done clunkily, but when it's done well, it's just, if you know that kind of little thrill of kind of going, oh, I remember him.
Yeah.
I really
I
love it.
mean, this is a bit more obvious, I think, than Ghost Written. It's not, you're not sort of looking for, yeah, there are bits that like it's sort of a reveal that comes later on, but there are also bits that are slightly more obvious perhaps. But yeah, there are bits where characters bump into each other that you're not expecting, and then you realize how they know each other or something that's been happening that you'd not quite picked up on. And yeah, it's like, honestly, can't believe its debut. It's really, really well written. So, and I think very much the sort of book that you enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, that's going straight on my list of books to buy next year for sure. That sounds fantastic. Right, so we've got two novels in translation this week, two very short novels, which is a blessed relief. So we haven't actually talked about which way around we're going to do this, so I'm just going to say them in order that I've got them in my pile here. We've got Pedro Páramo by Juan Rulfo, which is translated from the Spanish by Margaret Sayers Peden. And we have Permafrost by Eva Baltazar, which is translated from the Catalan by Julia Sanchez. Which one do you want to go with first?
Oh, just let's do Pedro Páramo.
Let's do Pedro. So I chose this one, and this one came to my attention. I have to say, I'd never heard of it. It's a kind of Mexican classic. So it was originally written in 1955, and this edition has then come out. This English translation has then come out from Serpent's Tail in 2014. This came to my attention a couple of years ago, kind of at the height of the American Dirt controversy, which we probably don't need to outline for people listening to this, but briefly was a big American novel that, rightly, I would suggest some Latinx authors were just like, hang on a minute. Maybe ask someone who's actually from the place that you're talking about. So there was a big controversy about that. But something that came out of it was that there was a list published, I think, in The Guardian, that was sort of 10 novels you should read by actually Mexican authors. And this was one of them. And I just thought it sounded completely brilliant and completely up my street. So it's, on the face of it, the story is quite simple. It's about a guy called Juan Presido, Presido. excuse my pronunciation, who, after the death of his mother, sort of goes to fulfill his promise to her, which was that he would find his father. He would go to the village that his mother was originally from and find Pedro Páramo, which is his father, which he does. Well, he goes to the village. The village, by the time he gets there, is a ghost town. And we discover quite quickly that that's quite literal, in that he keeps thinking he's meeting people, but they're all dead. Lots of ghosts start talking to him, and you end up, it's like a, this hallucinogenic narrative where you've got ghosts talking to him, then you've got flashbacks to the past, you've got what's happening to him right in the moment is a flashback to the father, there's a flashback to the priest of the village, there's a flashback to the death of Pedro Páramo's one of, well, another of Pedro Páramo's sons. It's just this sort of wild, hallucinogenic, utterly batshit novel that I totally loved. I just thought it was I was so sort of sucked into it immediately. Like, I read it really quickly and sort of, I think it is one of those books that you kind of have to read sort of basically in one or two goes. Otherwise, I think you kind of totally lose track of what the hell's going on. But I sort of felt like I was like spat out the other end of the novel. It's just like, is anyone not a ghost? I don't know. But yeah, so I was a big fan. I think you were slightly less of a fan than I was, though.
I really struggled with it, which I feel like a bit of a weird turnaround because this is the sort of book on paper that I should love. And I struggled to get into it. I was like, what on earth's going on? And then I did get into it, and then I got really annoyed by the end. And when I say the ending, it's like the last 40 pages, I think. It starts interspersing Pedro Páramo's story as some of the ghost telling bits. And then you just get a load of Pedro Páramo at the end. And literally, I said to you, what happened to Juan? And you were like, he died. Did you miss that bit? Like, yeah, I did. Yeah, I did. And I don't know what it was about. Because I read it in like short bursts, to be honest. I read it over, like, it took me quite a long time to read it. So I didn't get that hook where you sort of hooked in. I wasn't there. Part of what interested me about that was, I write, so for someone who writes magic realism, I'm not a big fan of markers. I'm going to get hung, drawn, and quartered for this. But like, I like some of his short stories. I think they're brilliant. 100 Years of Solitude, it's more, there's too much realism and not enough magic for me. Whereas this one, it's all magic, and there's no realism to like grasp onto. I think that was it. I was struggling to find something to like, I couldn't orientate myself in it, I think is what I was struggling.
Yeah, I do know what you mean. I think sometimes you, and I say this as someone that normally loves a big traditional narrative arc, as you know. I think that's what's so discombobulating about it is there is no A to B. Like, the time scales are all off. Yeah, one dies in the middle of it, and you're not even quite sure how he dies, but he just wakes up in a grave, except he is dead, but he's in a grave with a woman called Dorothea. And then they're listening to all the other, so they're listening to the voices of the ghosts that are in all the other graves around them, and the ghosts are telling some more of their stories, and so it is really discombobulating, I think. But I think there was something about it that kind of, it's sort of swirling. Swirling is the word that I keep coming back to with this book. It's sort of different sort of ghosts sort of swirl in and tell a bit, and then they go off again. And of course, because time doesn't, I guess time doesn't exist to ghosts, right? They're just there. They're just, there's no linear time ceases to exist, and that's what all breaks down.
And thing is, I like that idea. I like the idea of the ghost turning up and being obsessed with one little thing that they have to keep talking about, which is what seems to be happening.
Yeah.
Like, I like the premise of it, I think it's really interesting. It was the execution, I think, that I didn't quite gel with.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, because I mean, I think in some ways I was expecting to find this more difficult than I did. But I didn't. Well done, mate.
I mean, we got there. It's only taken six series.
I found the priest really fascinating as a character.
Oh yeah, total arsehole.
Yeah, I know, but it was like he everything deserted this village, like everyone deserted this village, and by the end of it, there's so all these basically a lot of the men of the village, they go off to fight, and there's all these kind of rebels swirling around, and Pedro's bankrolling a kind of group to go and join them to sort of protect himself, basically. But you realised at the end that the priest has up and joined the rebels, and he's off as well. And it felt to me as if this village has emptied out to the extent that sort of even God's deserted it. Do you know what I mean? It's like there was no, it was so completely left empty that the ghosts are all that is left.
Well, also the whole thing with the priest as well is that he won't give any of them salvation unless they pay him loads of money. So the only person who gets salvation is Pedro Páramo because he's the only person who's got any bloody money.
Who's
So
arguably the worst of the lot?
yeah, so of course God's deserted him because they're all just trapped in purgatory because of it. I mean, if
Yes.
that's what you believe, which I, it's set in a Catholic country, isn't it? So I'm assuming that we're gonna take that as read.
Yeah. And then there's also this character, Susanna, who, the way it's written, as if, well, certainly the impression I get is sort of, she's the only woman that Pedro has ever loved. There's certainly been a lot of women, not least Juan's mother, who's sort of then disappeared with small Juan, as it were. But this woman, Susanna, who's the daughter of a guy who sort of doesn't want anything to do with Pedro, but basically Pedro's got all these blokes that work for him, and he's gone and lured him back with money, essentially, or land, and then he gets bumped off, obviously. But on the condition that Susanna marries Pedro. And Susanna is also clearly not quite with it. It is sort of quite mad in a way, but Pedro's sort of obsessed with her. She's kind of fascinating as a character, and she's one of the characters that that Juan here is talking in the grave. You know, she's like mumbling. There's lots of mumbling in this book. There's lots of mumbling and murmuring and sort of not quite distinct. It all sort of fits in a way. It's just none of it's very distinct.
Yeah, but I suppose that's because I was before we started recording and I'd sort of sat down to think about what I might want to say about it. I was trying to think about what he was doing because I mean the themes in it are massive. So we're talking about wealth, greed, power, religion, all the sort of like big classic themes in this weird little, what is it, 130 page book. But also that idea of like family history, and you never quite get to the truth of it anyway, do you? You get sort of different bits of stories from different people. So yeah, that sense of things not quite fitting together. So like you said, just bits of things that are swirling around.
Yeah, and there's a lot of kind of descent. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's not just in terms of half the novel is narrated from a grave, but you know, there's mines. There's lots of kind of undergroundness. It's sort of like this. It's almost like a kind of descent into hell. Do you know what I mean? Like everything is sort of down in the ground, of the ground, and there's nothing left on top, I guess.
Yeah. It's one of those that I felt, so I didn't have time to read it again. It felt like it deserved at least a second reading and very much like something that you'd study and go away and write about. That's what it felt like to me. Not in a bad way, in a like, it felt like on first reading that there were lots of things that I've probably missed.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there were sections that I did go back and read again, like the bit where you find out that Juan's died. I went back and read several times because I was just like, am I right? Like, I'm pretty sure he's dead. is he actually dead? Is this literal death or is this not literal death? Who's talking? Is he a ghost? Who's not? Am I a ghost at this point?
We're all ghosts, I think,
We're
Viv.
all ghosts. What's going on? Yeah, I think it definitely would stand some rereading. There's a my edition. I know, so you've got the same edition. There's a foreword by Gabriel Garcia Marquez who talks about how much he loves this book and how he read it through twice straight away, and then he memorized the whole book, which I just think is wild.
Yeah, and then he credits it with him going off and writing 100 Years of Solitude and basically creating magic realism. So mildly important
Fairly important in
then.
the canon. Yeah, I bet there's a lot of Mexican school kids who've had to write essays on it.
Probably, and 100 Years of Solitude, which I have never made it all the way through.
You know what? I've never even started it, so you're one up on me. Yeah, so let's move on to the other book then. And this is the other. So I didn't dislike Permafrost at all. I really, really liked it. I just preferred Pedro. Permafrost by Eva Baltazar, which, as I said, was translated from the Catalan by Julia Sanchez. This was published in, well, this translation was published in 2021 by And Other Stories. Another really short book, and this is about a, well, as the back cover calls her, a no bullshit lesbian narrator. And it's her sort of pinballing around life, not quite settling to anything. Again, she's a very kind of discontented, very spiky sort of person, and she never really settles to anything. You know, she just wants to like read and have sex. That's really all she's in. I
Well,
mean, you know, good for her. Good for her.
and also a content note for people thinks about suicide, there's a lot of suicide ideation as well.
Yes, there is a
I mean, it
lot.
starts off, she's contemplating it on the first page.
Yes. There's lots of it.
Yeah.
Sex, death, and reading.
Basically, yeah. I liked this a lot more than Pedro Páramo, sorry. I thought I'd quite like to be friends with her, actually, even though she was an arsehole. I was like, I
In
like.
our gang, does she join the gang?
I think she joins the gang. I don't think we have
Wow.
we had anybody join the gang this year.
I'm not sure if we have, but so she's in.
She's in. She's definitely in. Yeah, I mean, partly I love this because it's really funny. Like she
It is
totally
very funny.
ribs her mum. It's hilarious. So there's one bit that I really want to read that's really short because there's a couple of chapters that are very, very short. And this is one of them. So she, I mean, there is a storyline to it. She ends up going to become a nanny for a family in Scotland. And then she finds what she thinks are cancerous moles on her stomach. Kirsty's laughing because we know how that turns out. And also her sister has a breakup and then she has a baby. And the bit with the breakup. There's a bit we'll come back to because she keeps asking about what it's like to have sex with a woman, and her reply is hilarious as well. But this bit, because like she just rag on her mum, basically, she cops for it. So this is chapter 13. Fucking cell phone. Every time it rings, I think I'll take it down with me. Take my contacts down too while I'm at it. It's my sister. Hello. Hi, honey. Mom, it's a girl. She's here. Your little niece has come into the world. Let me put your sister on. Being the bearer of important news, the only climax mum has ever known.
it is very kind of acerbic and very very witty and very funny. I definitely did not dislike it. I did really, really like it, and I think what I loved about it was the very quick way that you've got the whole book. Well, as we said, it's not a long book, 130 pages. And most of it is this very spiky, you know, suicide, you know, talking about suicide, having lots of sex with lots of different women, you know, not committing, very commitment phobic. You know, there's a bit where, again, really funny, there's a bit where she's got involved with Veronica, who's, you know, she thinks his mother and they're having incredible sex. And chapter 16 opens with, "You know, I cannot marry you. We're lesbians," I exclaim in English. Veronica smiles. Of course you can, since January 30th. The legalization of gay marriage was a big win, don't get me wrong, but I've been getting on fine, just fine without it. And she pretends that she's been having an affair with another woman, so that she can't marry Veronica. So she's very, very kind of flighty, doesn't want to get tied down to anything. And then, without giving spoilers, there's something that happens in her family at the end that absolutely turns it on the head, and she's in this situation that is completely different to anything she thought she was going to be in. But clearly, it you can tell even just in the few pages at the end that it sort of completely changes her. I mean, I don't think I'm stretching that, but it goes from, kind of, suicidal ideation to this bit where she's like, oh, and I found out that death was transferable, and this thing happens, and it just sort of turns everything on its head, but in a kind of surprisingly tender way, I think.
And I wonder whether it sets up for the book that comes after. So she's written a second book
I think
that's
there's
not.
three books.
Oh, is
So
there?
when I looked, it said something, it was like the first in a series of three.
Oh,
I don't know
interesting.
how loose or tight a series that is, whether it's
Right.
just sort of loosely connected or loosely in the same vein as trilogy, or whether it's a direct, like the same characters. I genuinely don't know.
Yeah, I'd be intrigued to read it anyway.
Yeah.
So going back to the I said we mentioned the talking about sex with this. So her sister gets really annoying and he's constantly asking her what I think there's about three chapters that start with her sister asking what it's like to have sex with a woman. So she says this to her. Oh dear. So she asks about Jackson Pollock and she says she doesn't know anything about Jackson Pollock. So she goes, this is an action painting, I begin. Action painting is the product of impatience. She pulls a face like a cricket. Around the mid-20th century, there was a period when artists were no longer being challenged. For centuries, they had struggled with a series of problems: motif, depth, form, color, realism, fidelity, light, everything. In other words, they'd run out of lines of inquiry. And then Pollock rocked up with his huge unplanned canvases stretched out on the floor and wham, wham, look at this. I show a number three, flip pages. Number five, flip pages. Number 34, a superb piece with that horrific red thinking head and its two yellow hemispheres. Look, I tell her, clear, simple manipulation of raw material, pure experimentation. Pollock splatters canvases driven by the spontaneity of the moment. A work of art isn't only the end result, it's art in time, art in real time, in action as simple and impulsive as drawing by a child. But there's a sophisticated concern below the surface, an interesting process, life's immensity concentrated in that process. Do you get what I'm saying? Sort of. All right. So now you know sort so now you sort of know what it's like to fuck a woman. Like genius.
There are so many really good lines. One of my favorite is really near the beginning, where she says, at 23, it's too late for everything. Not until our 40s do we realize that there's still time.
Yep, which
Yep.
a line that could only have been written by someone in the 40s. The
Yeah,
other thing
exactly.
that I thought was really good about this, and considering, I mean, we should sell the episode on this, considering how popular Sex Week's been. The sex writing in this is some of the best sex writing I've ever read, I think.
100% agree. It's really, really good.
So particularly, there's a really interesting sort of section. So like page 68, 69, 70, where she's talking about her sexual awakening. So she's 11, and they've been doing reproduction at school. And then one of her friends invites her back to her house and puts a porn film on.
Yeah, there's like loads of them.
Which is interesting. And then she goes home and masturbates and thinks about her friends. So she's clearly worked out that she's gay by this point. But just the writing in that section is really, really brilliant, I thought.
Oh yeah, I mean the writing in the whole book is fantastic, and because I'm sort of shamefully ignorant about Catalan literature. What I didn't know till I read the translators afterward is that Baltazar is a poet, and then the translator talks about the fact that I knew her as a poet first and foremost. And I think the language, she's got that sort of economy of language, I think, that that she just, nothing is sort of over explained. It's all very kind of concise and very exact.
It's like when we talk about the harpy last week. I mean,
Yeah.
Hunter again, poet.
Yeah, absolutely.
I hate
Absolutely.
them. They write really brilliant short novels. They're small.
How dare they? How dare they?
So rude.
So rude.
The other thing I liked about this that happens near the beginning, and I think it only happens once. I'm going to attempt to read this, which is going to be interesting, because I'm quite interested in the way she plays with form. I mean, she plays with time because things go backwards and forwards, but also she plays with form a little bit. She really loves a list, which I love. When I did my master's in creative writing, I used to write lists in lots of like stuff that I was writing, and one of my classmates hated it, so I did it even more. But the other thing she does, and this is right near the beginning. So this is the end of chapter five. So her sister's rung to say that she's having a baby. And it means that she's going to have to talk about well, she's asked her if she's happy, and she's like, I lie. And she's like, I can't, there's no emotion there. I can't pull it up. So what she does instead is this. She goes, that's great, I say. Then I talk. I rattle on for a minute straight, hoping to shortcut any attempts to plumb my emotional compost pile. So I'm going to see if I can do this. There is no punctuation in this next sentence, this next section. That's great, really great. Oh my God, it's so amazing to be an ant twice over. It's like being a fully fledged ant, like going from wearing a monocle to wearing a pair of glasses, or from riding a tricycle to riding a bicycle. I finally feel like I've got my life as an ant under control. Hell, you left me hanging for so long, but suddenly here it is, this little person who's decided to charge right into the wonderful business of living, and it couldn't have hoped for better parents, parents with stable jobs and a gorgeous house with a bedroom, just for her or for him, because of course 2 months in, you don't have any way of knowing yet whether it'll be a boy or a girl, though I don't actually know why I'm talking about it in the future, since it's already a boy or a girl. It already exists inside your belly. Oh, it must be amazing to be pregnant and feel life growing inside you. I'm sure this pregnancy will be as terrific as the first one, and that everything will be great, just great. And it's so sweet of you to share this news with me. You've made my morning. This is the kind of news that makes a person feel like it's all worth it. And besides, when the family gets together for Christmas, there won't be 13 of us anymore, which people say is bad luck, but one more little boy or girl, and that's just terrific. A colossal effort that leaves me dead tired. Seriously, this is the sort of behaviour that drives people to medicate.
That is one of my favorite sections. It's so good.
I loved how she pulled it off, and you can imagine her do that thing where you just talk and talk and talk because you don't want the other person to have a chance to say anything. I just thought it was brilliantly done, and it made me wonder actually how much editing went into getting that section right, because it looks like it's easy, but it's not easy to write something that flows. Well, maybe it is. Maybe she just wrote it out at once and it was done,
But
but
not even just to write that, but then to translate it, to
yeah.
translate it in a way that to the English ear sounds completely right and completely natural. Translators absolutely boggle my mind.
Yeah, and there's some interesting stuff I think in the translators. And I always feel a bit, I don't know, I feel a bit weird about translators' notes. I don't want them to over explain to me what they've done. Like, I'm happy to seek that stuff out. I don't necessarily want it in the book. But I thought she speaks really interestingly about listening to the rhythms of the sentences and getting the rhythms of the sentences right, and her word choices because of that.
Yeah, and it's definitely, I think there's more of that because she's a poet. She's going to be so much more attuned to rhythm and, word position and, that sort of thing. So it's like an extra, translation is so much more than just decoding the words on the page, right? It's a whole different form of writing.
Yeah, and yeah, because I was gonna say, because you're translating it into another language, and that's a bit like, oh yeah, but like, you're translating the sense of it as well as the word. So it's you're not trying to do a literal translation, are you? Or at least I assume most people aren't trying to do a literal translation. They're trying to get the sense right.
Yeah, absolutely. And the impact, you know, from in the kind of the impact from a literature sense of and all those other things that happen to us when we're reading sort of great writing. It's you know, you could have something that was brilliantly written and badly translated. You know, it's such a kind of underrated skill, and I think it's only good and right. There's been so much more sort of attention recently on making sure that translators are properly credited and having their name on book jackets, and you know, because it's so something I think that the Man Booker International, it's not Man anymore, is it? The International Booker Prize does right is that the author and the translator are given equal billing, and it's between them, and it's the two of them on stage, and you know, because it is such a it's such an interesting relationship, I think, between the writer and the translator. I think it's also such a position, you know, it's such a relationship of trust, especially if the author doesn't speak the language it's being translated into.
Yeah, and I think it's always interesting to listen to people talk about that relationship as well and how they manage it. Some people like seem to check every little thing, and some people just go off and do it and then come back if they've got a query. And yeah, it's interesting how people do it in different ways.
Yeah, really
And I suppose
interesting.
the longer you work with the same writer, the more you get. I think I've forgotten her name. It's Anne something. The woman who translates Elena Ferrante is really interesting because she's one of the few people who actually speaks to the writer about, you know, so must know, because she does all her interviews for her. So she must know her really well to be like, she's in a position where she actually goes out and talks about the book because Ferrante remains anonymous.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
I've only read the first one. The My Brilliant Friend. I've not read the rest of the series.
Oh, I've read two of those, but I've read some of her other ones as well. So, like, everything I've read is brilliant.
Should read more. There's just so many things to read.
Yep. What are we reading next week then, Kirsty?
Having to check because I can't remember. I know it's Alligator. And I know
It's
it's
short story
Falls.
week next week. Well,
Sorry.
later short story week. Normally we have short story week earlier in the series, but we've got it early. Oh, it's because we put the two books together because they were both about animals. So there's no other link apart from short stories that have an animal in the title of the book.
Yes, so we have next week, we have Dinosaurs on Other Planets by Danielle McLaughlin and Alligator and Other Stories by Dima Azayat. So yeah, short story week with animals.
Can't
Neither can I.
Anyway.
Genuinely, I actually have to say, of all the books that we had planned for this series, these are the two of the ones I've been most looking forward to. So I'm very much hoping that we go out on a high.
Well, you know, it's end of term feeling, isn't it? It's
It is a bit. We're all
end of
D1
this.
happy.
Yeah, it's end of the series. It's nearly Christmas. We're knackered. We've had a year.
Bring on
Anything
the
could
short
happen next
stories.
week. Yeah, come
Bring me
along
the
and join
dinosaurs.
us. Yeah. In the meantime, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. We're both on Instagram. I've given up with other social media. So Kirsty is at Other Kirsty and I'm at Naomi Frisby. Well, Kirsty's laughing at me, but like we've both what dabbled in Threads, dabbled in Blue Sky. I've got bored with all of it. So Instagram it is. Otherwise, we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.